CD4 tests. Similar deficiencies plague tests that count CD4 plus helper T cells. AIDS doctors look at low CD4 cell counts as the key marker for AIDS diagnoses. However, not a single study confirms this most important principle of the HIV-only theory, that HIV destroys CD4 cells by means of an infection. Furthermore, even the most significant of all AIDS studies, the 1994 Concord study, questions using helper cell counts as a diagnostic test for AIDS. The problem is the use of a surrogate endpoint, which is notoriously imprecise. Many studies corroborate the skepticism. One of these is the 1996 paper, Surrogate Endpoints in Clinical Studies, Are We Being Misled? Published in the Annals of Internal Medicine, the paper concludes that CD4 T cell count in the HIV setting is as uninformative as a toss of a coin. In other words, not at all. Mullis added, "Now, is there a test that can definitively tell you if you are infected with the virus? What is that test?" The party line, at all costs, or else. Critics of the HIV-AIDS hypothesis invariably cite Koch's postulates as the most profound embarrassment for Gallo's theory. In 1884, Nobel laureate Robert Koch, the father of bacteriology, first outlined the classical methodologies for proving causation between a pathogen and a disease. Summarizing Koch's postulates for the Journal of Investigative Dermatology, Julia A. Segre wrote, "As originally stated, the four criteria are, 1. The microorganism must be found in diseased but not healthy individuals. 2. The microorganism must be cultured from the diseased individual. 3. Inoculation of a healthy individual with the cultured microorganism must recapitulate the disease. And finally, 4. The microorganism must be re-isolated from the inoculated diseased individual and matched to the original microorganism." Koch's postulates have been critically important in establishing the criteria whereby the scientific community agrees that a microorganism causes a disease. Virologists, and every trial lawyer and judge, consider Koch's four criteria the gold standard for proof that a particular microorganism causes a particular malignancy. The problem of AIDS without HIV. Koch's first postulate requires that a truly pathogenic virus can be found in large quantities in every patient suffering from the disease. The failure of the HIV-AIDS hypothesis to meet this critical threshold remains one of Dr. Fauci's most exasperating dilemmas. For starters, Gallo claimed that he found HIV virus in fewer than half of the ailing AIDS patients from whom he drew blood. Furthermore, every one of the 30 discrete illnesses we now call AIDS occurs also in persons uninfected by HIV. In fact, AIDS commonly occurs in people who test HIV negative. If HIV is truly the only cause of AIDS, this should not be possible. Soon after Robert Gallo's historic announcement, doctors around the country and CDC officials started seeing patients with low CD4 counts and signature AIDS diseases like PCP and immune system dysfunction, but who tested negative for HIV. Many of the victims were white heterosexual women. Dr. Fauci and the CDC kept this awkward information secret. Fauci funded AIDS researchers, Dr. Fauci's PIs, also kept mum when they encountered such patients. By 1992, media science writers also knew about these HIV-free AIDS cases, but they dutifully self-censored while awaiting signals from Dr. Fauci and the medical cartel. Lawrence Altman, the chief medical writer for the New York Times, confessed to Science magazine that he did not break the story because he didn't think it was his paper's place to announce something without the CDC's go-ahead. Then, in the first days of the 1992 Amsterdam AIDS conference, a naive young Newsweek reporter, Jeffrey Cowley, innocently reported a cascade of cases of non-HIV AIDS that he uncovered during quiet confessional conversations with Dr. Fauci's AIDS researchers. Several scientists confided to Cowley their bewildered alarm at the large number of AIDS patients who were uninfected with HIV. Cowley's report almost precipitated the collapse of Dr. Fauci's entire, carefully fortified, HIV-only theology. "The patients are sick or dying, and most of them have risk factors," Cowley reported in Newsweek. He described a dozen such cases of non-HIV patients with AIDS-like symptoms, including brain lesions, corresponding cognitive deficits, chronic aggravation of herpes viruses, depleted C4 cells, PCP pneumonia, and immune system collapse. What they don't have is HIV. The Newsweek article shattered the taboo. Conferees took the public disclosure as a signal that they could now discuss the previously verboten subject of AIDS patients without HIV. Dr. Fauci's researchers, gathered in Amsterdam, an ocean away from his heavy hand, suddenly began sharing their own stories of AIDS without HIV across the United States and Europe. With the floodgates opened by Newsweek threatening to sweep away Dr. Fauci's official orthodoxy, Dr. Fauci raced out to Andrews Air Force Base with CDC AIDS Task Force Director James Curran and flew to the Netherlands on Air Force 2 on a mission to quell the uprising. Curran, the head of the CDC's AIDS division, had famously conspired with Gallo to take the antibody patent from the French. But by the time the two bureaucrats arrived, the horse had left the stable. Dr. Fauci and Curran had to sit through a series of rollicking conference sessions as mobs of reporters, mutinous scientists, and enraged activists besieged them with case studies and unanswerable questions. Public health regulators, physicians, and researchers expressed indignation that Dr. Fauci hadn't come clean with them. Many physicians caring for AIDS patients were furious that the government agency had not informed them about the non-HIV AIDS cases. Curran confessed that the CDC had known about these cases for years. He feebly protested, "These are not cases of AIDS," reasoning with circular gymnastics that they couldn't be AIDS since the definition of AIDS requires the presence of HIV. Dr. Fauci weakly reassured the gathering that he would soon resolve the crisis. The New York Native reported that Dr. Fauci, the little man with the compensatory ego, looked like he was going to have a nervous breakdown in Amsterdam. "We kept waiting to see him curled up in a fetal position and crying hysterically, desperate for forgiveness, desperate to create a smokescreen to make everyone forget how he has elbowed every critical question about HIV out of the way." Dr. Fauci was trying to sell himself as an open-minded scientist. He was telling people, "Don't panic, don't panic." In the weeks following the Amsterdam conference, the number of cases identified in the United States alone continued to grow almost daily. Within a few weeks, the escalating cascade forced CDC to admit to 82 certified cases in 15 states. It was a pitiful underestimate. Duisberg sent a letter to Science offering to provide a list of references to more than 800 HIV-free immunodeficiencies and AIDS-defining diseases in all major American and European risk groups, along with references to more than 2,200 HIV-free African AIDS cases. Duisberg afterward identified more than 4,000 documented AIDS cases in the peer-reviewed scientific literature in which there is no trace of HIV or HIV antibodies. This number is impressive because Dr. Fauci had cultivated strong institutional deterrence to such descriptions, and because formal scientific papers never describe the vast majority of AIDS cases. In an editorial for the Los Angeles Times, Steve Himoff allowed that reports of AIDS without HIV would appear to signal at least partial, temporary vindication of Duisberg. Describing Duisberg as the unofficial leader of the revisionists, an international star of virology long before anyone heard of AIDS, and not just another conspiratorialist, Himoff observed that Duisberg's arguments have the ring of common sense. If there is even a remote chance that Duisberg is correct, and the latest reports increase that possibility, then the powers that be must leap into action. New York native publisher Charles Ortleb commented, "It should have been the end of the HIV theory, and absolute proof that the CDC had gotten the definition and cause of AIDS wrong." The fact that HIV-negative AIDS was also occurring in chronic fatigue syndrome patients, CFS, fortified suspicions of many virus experts that AIDS and CFS were part of the same neuroimmunological epidemic. A large contingent of HIV-AIDS critics, although not Peter Duisberg, had been clamoring that CFS and AIDS were a single disease, neither caused by HIV. To derail this lethal heresy, Dr. Fauci had set the compass for the medical community's reprehensible dismissal of CFS as a psychosomatic illness. Following Dr. Fauci's lead, doctors dubbed CFS as yuppie flu, characterizing it as a neurotic affliction among women genetically unequipped for high-pressure corporate jobs that suddenly opened to them in the 1980s, coterminous with the lockstep pandemics of AIDS and CFS. A September 6, 1992 Newsweek article by Jeffrey Cowley asked, "AIDS or chronic fatigue?" Though Cowley took some heat for the article, he was merely voicing the quiet suspicion among many of Dr. Fauci's own PIs that non-HIV AIDS was actually CFS, and that CFS was simply another name for AIDS when it occurred in heterosexuals who tested negative for HIV. As more cases come to light, Cowley observed, it's becoming clear that the newly defined syndrome has as much in common with CFS as it does with AIDS. Tony Fauci moved quickly to silence this existential threat. 3 weeks after the Amsterdam riot, the CDC sponsored a special meeting at its Atlanta headquarters, inviting the scientists reporting HIV-free AIDS cases. In attendance was a doleful Cowley, the Newsweek journalist, by now on a short leash with a choke collar. In a brazen move to explain away the anomaly of AIDS without HIV, Dr. Fauci declared that the unexplained AIDS cases represented a new disease. To avoid suspicion that his new disease was, after all, CFS, Dr. Fauci labeled his discovery idiopathic CD4+ lymphocytopenia, or ICL. In this tongue twister, idiopathic means of unknown source. It might also have been Dr. Fauci's ironic play on the word idiot. But such was his wizardry that everyone just swallowed it without questions. The press meekly nodded at his circular reasoning, like religious zealots jotting down the words of an infallible pope. For the record, I believe that HIV is a cause of AIDS, but Dr. Fauci's acknowledgement of non-HIV AIDS shows that causation is more complex than the official theology. Dr. Fauci had somehow resuscitated his theory from certain death by erecting an arbitrary wall between AIDS with and sans HIV. Because there was no evidence the mystery illness was contagious, Dr. Fauci hazarded a guess to the tractable reporters that the blood supply was probably safe. He offered no evidence to support this assurance, and the kowtowing media requested none. That was more than enough for Cowley. Cowley, the Newsweek reporter, almost lost his career, Charles Ortlieb told me. Newsweek published a remorseful article, and Cowley stopped reporting on AIDS cases without HIV or even Dr. Fauci's new disease, ICL. Then, on August 18th, New York Newsday revealed that two of the non-HIV AIDS patients had chronic fatigue syndrome, reigniting the dangerous controversy. Dr. Fauci rushed to appear on CNN's Larry King Live to reassure the general public that the new illness was not a threat to people outside the AIDS risk groups. Writing in the New York Native, Nina Ostrom described Dr. Fauci's interview with King. King began by asking Fauci to describe what he thought was happening in the mysterious AIDS cases in which patients develop severe immunodeficiency and types of infections suffered by AIDS patients but are not infected with HIV. Fauci kept saying that between 20 and 30 such cases had been identified. Dr. Fauci knew that CDC had already confirmed 82 cases in 15 states, and Duesberg had found thousands documented in PubMed, the NIH official peer review archives. And because such a small number of people were affected, it really was nothing to worry about. Fauci said it wasn't clear that these cases represented a new type of AIDS. These patients' immunodeficiency could, he stressed, be caused by something other than an infectious agent. Fauci speculated that the cases might not even represent a new illness, but that increasingly sophisticated testing of people's immune systems was turning up what could be background immunodeficiencies, whatever that is. Ostrom described Dr. Fauci's awkward denial when one caller to the show asked whether the new mystery illnesses had anything to do with chronic fatigue syndrome. Fauci stated emphatically that it did not. Fauci was clearly uncomfortable talking about chronic fatigue syndrome, Ostrom reported, and couldn't quite figure out where to look, so his eyes darted everywhere. The show ended with an angry call from a physician in the Midwest who treats AIDS patients. He demanded to know why Fauci and other health officials had not informed physicians about the cases of non-HIV AIDS before the information appeared in Newsweek. Shouldn't the doctors know about this before the mass media? The doctor asked sarcastically. Fauci became very defensive, asserting that it had only become clear in the last couple of weeks that the non-HIV AIDS cases constituted a real phenomenon, and therefore there had previously been nothing to inform the physicians of. He did not look happy at the show's end. Ostrom added this observation. Fauci's good on television as long as he's being touted as President George Bush's hero, or patted on the back for rushing toxic drugs through the approval process without adequate safety testing. But when reporters start acting like reporters, as they have since the non-HIV cases came to light, Fauci's thin skin gets him into trouble. He becomes defensive, condescending, and sarcastic. King initially scheduled Peter Duesberg to appear on the same show, and apparently canceled Duesberg at Dr. Fauci's insistence. The problem of HIV without AIDS. Koch's first postulate also requires that the suspected pathogen should only be found in sick individuals and never in healthy individuals. It is therefore equally frustrating for HIV-only aficionados that widespread PCR use quickly revealed hundreds of thousands of individuals with HIV and no sign of illness. Dr. Fauci initially predicted that all of these individuals would die of AIDS within 2 years. Later, he doubled their life expectancy to 4 years, and then to 8. Then he stopped talking about these upcoming tragedies altogether. Today, even Dr. Fauci's most loyal clergymen acknowledge that there are over 165,000 Americans and millions of individuals globally who carry the HIV virus without ill effect. According to CDC estimates, approximately one-third of HIV positives in the United States do not know their status. If this is the case, Harvey Bialy points out, there should be a huge number of people dying suddenly of AIDS. This is not happening. In fact, the vast majority of those who test positive for HIV remain healthy for years. Duesberg and other critics argued that there is meager proof that people with HIV alone will not live a normal lifespan. Dr. Fauci has also taken energetic precautions to ensure that nobody study the prevalence of healthy HIV-infected people. In July 1996, Newsday reported that Dr. Fauci had suddenly aborted a $16 million five-year study of the phenomenon midstream. According to journalist Lori Garrett's July 11th story in Newsday, key HIV contract is killed, some see retribution at hands of NIH official, was the largest study on HIV/AIDS ever commissioned, involving research from over 100 scientists from leading institutions, including Harvard, the Aaron Diamond AIDS Research Center in Manhattan, Northwestern University, Chicago, Duke University, North Carolina, and the University of Alabama. One of the study's central purposes was to examine the question that Dr. Fauci apparently didn't want answered, why some HIV-infected individuals never succumb to AIDS. The five-year contract, which began in 1994 to fund this collaboration, formerly named the Correlates of HIV Immune Protections, or CHIPS, has no parallel in U.S. AIDS research. Dr. Fauci's action effectively scuttled a year's worth of work by about 100 independent scientists. Aaron Diamond's Dr. David Ho told Garrett, "I'd like to see if Tony could find a contract anywhere in his portfolio that could match the productivity of this one." Newsday reported that the shocking cancellation was a retaliation against a group of younger scientists among this group who had signed a report, the Levine Report, that criticized NIH's policy of only funding research that supported Dr. Fauci's HIV/AIDS orthodoxies. "This is payback time for Tony Fauci," said AIDS activist Greg Gonsalves of Treatment Action Group, the offshoot of ACT UP, formed to openly receive pharma funding. He told Newsday, "It was an act of retribution by Tony Fauci, plain and simple." In reporting the incident, the New York native quoted NIAID insiders, New York native, July 22, 1996, complaining that Dr. Fauci had fostered a reprisal culture at NIH. They said that their boss's favorite expression was, "What goes around comes around." Gonsalves called the cancellation a vendetta against the young scientists in the group who dared to ask for science-based funding strategies. "It's just as likely that Dr. Fauci was searching for an excuse to terminate a study that threatened the entire HIV/AIDS paradigm." The problem with isolating the virus. Koch's second postulate is that the virus can be isolated from an ill individual and made to grow in pure culture. Highly respected scientists, including Etienne de Arvin, argued that HIV has never been isolated or grown in pure culture. Both Montagnier and Gallo have periodically acknowledged this deficiency. Instigating disease with cultured HIV. Koch's third postulate requires that the cultured microorganisms should cause disease when introduced into healthy individuals. Duesberg and others argue till this day that this proof is incomplete. In 1984, Montagnier acknowledged that the only way to prove that HIV causes AIDS is to show this on an animal model. No one has tried injecting HIV into a healthy human being, but scientists have stuck all kinds of mice and rats and monkeys and chimpanzees, and none of them got anything resembling human AIDS. No one has yet been able to induce AIDS by inoculating a healthy experimental animal with a cultured microorganism. There is no animal model for AIDS, agreed Nobel laureate for chemistry Walter Gilbert in 1989. And where there is no animal model, you cannot establish Koch's postulates. This failure by itself, said Gilbert, left such a gaping hole in Gallo's theory that he would not be surprised if there were another cause of AIDS, and even that HIV is not involved. Evolutionary biologist James Lyons Weiler argues that genetic sequencing of infected individuals proves sexual transmission of HIV. He also points to a 1991 judicial decision against a Florida dentist, Dr. David Acker, who allegedly infected 5 patients with a contaminated drill as definitive proof of Koch Postulate 3. Subsequent investigations by 60 Minutes and others raised new doubts about the Acker verdict. Re-isolating the pathogen. Koch's 4th and final postulate is that the microorganism must be re-isolated from this inoculated experimental diseased host. Duisberg argues that vigorous efforts by HIV/AIDS proponents to satisfy the postulates have all failed. In Jamel Tahi's 1996 documentary, AIDS, The Doubt, Professor Luc Montagnier admitted that after years of trying, no one had succeeded. There is no scientific proof. Montagnier therefore concludes that HIV causes AIDS. Koch's principles are still taught to every student of epidemiology, but his name is now a source of embarrassment rather than admiration and affection among AIDS researchers. From cases I have litigated, I know that entire court cases hinge on the capacity of the attorneys and scientists to persuade a fact finder that the proponent of causation has satisfied Koch's postulates. It is the standard protocol for proving the causative relationship of a pathogen to a particular disease. Therefore, it came as a shocking revelation for me to learn that there remain possibly viable arguments that the HIV/AIDS hypothesis had consistently failed that standard. In the American judicial system, that evidence would normally be sufficient to close a case. I am not opining on the science here. Viral load does not necessarily correlate to illness. Yet another acute embarrassment to Gallo's hypothesis is the problem of viral load. With most bacteriological and viral illnesses, increased viral load correlates with the progression of the disease and declines the patient's health. If HIV is the sole cause of AIDS, titers should be able to track an increase in viral loads as physical deterioration progresses. Traditional viruses such as herpes, influenza, smallpox, etc., only cause disease at very high titer, thousands or millions of infectious units per cubic millimeter of infected tissue. In contrast, HIV has proven barely to be found in AIDS patients, even in the final throes of illness. HIV can be detected, but only with difficulty because even the sickest AIDS patients simply don't have much virus to be found. And even more baffling, neither Dr. Fauci nor Gallo has ever credibly explained the fact that viral load from HIV is always at its greatest in the days immediately following infection. Logically, it would be during this period that the virus is most likely to cause devastating illness. And yet, the onset of AIDS symptoms almost always arrive decades later, an average 20 years following exposure, when viral loads are at their lowest. In 2006, A study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association once again shook the foundation of the past decade of AIDS science to its core and incited apoplexy among many HIV/AIDS advocates. A U.S. nationwide team of orthodox mainstream AIDS researchers, led by Drs. Benigno Rodriguez and Michael Letterman of Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, strongly challenged the claimed legitimacy of viral load testing, the standard method since 1996 for assessing patient health, predicting disease progression, and winning grant approval for new AIDS drugs. Their study of 2,800 positively tested people concluded, in over 90% of cases, viral load measures failed to predict or explain immune status. Today, Rodriguez's group stands by its conclusion that viral load is only able to predict progression to disease in 4% to 6% of so-called HIV positives studied, challenging much of the basis for current AIDS science and treatment policy. The Lancet published a study showing that decreases in so-called viral load did not translate into a decrease in mortality for people taking these highly toxic AIDS drug combinations. The multi-center study, the largest and longest of its kind, tracked the effects of Dr. Fauci's antivirals on some 22,000 previously treated HIV positives between 1995 and 2003 at 12 locations in Europe and the United States. The study refutes popular claims that HIV meds extend life and improve health. Can a retrovirus as elusive and rare as HIV cause deadly illness? Equally mysterious is the question of how an elusive, rare, difficult-to-find virus could be causing so much carnage. Peter Duisberg told me, if HIV was causing infections, you would never need a PCR, a machine that multiplies HIV segments a billionfold, to see whether a person is infected. Infection would be as obvious as it is with active flu or active polio. The body would be swarming with microbes. Lauritsen argues, the virus infects very, very few cells, as few as 1 in 100,000. And on top of that, it doesn't even kill the cells it infects. Since HIV typically infects so few cells, that means Dr. Fauci's antiviral concoctions like AZT must kill many healthy T cells in order to eliminate the few cells that are infected. It's worth considering that Dr. Fauci endorses administration of AZT and other chemotherapy concoctions for months on end or for as many years as AIDS patients manage to survive. Furthermore, I haven't found any evidence that HIV ever actually kills a T cell. They seem to instead get along quite well. For this reason, critics argue the collapse of the immune system cannot be plausibly explained merely by the presence of HIV. Duisberg is not surprised at the gaps in the evidence. After all, he says, how can a virus be so destructive when it first enters the body, then turns around and plays dead for 10, 20, 30 years? Yet this is the orthodoxy. Dr. J. A. Levy, M.D., a leading UC AIDS researcher, posits, HIV is a kind of time bomb virus that lies dormant in the body until, for some unknown and unexplainable reason, it modifies its own genetic structure and transforms into a fast-growing, virulent, deadly virus. Duisberg chuckles at this speculation. What kind of virus one day out of nowhere springs into action to destroy a person's immune system with no provocation? Gallo and Dr. Fauci originally claimed that HIV causes immunodeficiency by killing CD4 plus T cells. But even the most faithful acolytes no longer believe that HIV kills T cells in any way. Instead, they make what might seem to an outsider like a desperate pitch that HIV primes T cells to commit mass suicide at some later date. Dr. Fauci's followers have advanced this Jim Jones hypothesis to explain the lack of evidence for any cell-killing mechanism that can be attributed to HIV. Duisberg laughs at this explanation. No virus has ever behaved that way. There are many shortcomings in the theory that HIV causes all signs of AIDS, admits Luc Montagnier. Among the most outspoken dissidents of the HIV orthodoxy are biologist Eleni Papadopoulos and physician Val Turner of the Australian Perth Group. Papadopoulos and Turner believe the particles Gallo identified as HIV are not even retroviruses, but rather are a class of cellular debris generated entirely from within the human body. Even Luc Montagnier admitted in an interview with the journal Continuum in 1997 that after Roman effort with electron micrographs of the cell culture with which HIV was said to have been detected, no particles were visible with morphology typical of retroviruses. A British-German research team in 2006 proudly reported that finally the structure of the world's most deadly virus has been decoded and that they had succeeded in photographing HIV in a 3D quality never achieved before. But after independent scientists inspected the team's paper, they found that the images depicted appear to be a series of nondescript clumps of debris ranging wildly in sizes and shapes. The study was funded by Wellcome Trust that has had from its inception a collaborative relationship with the pharmaceutical industry, including Burroughs Wellcome, the pharmaceutical giant that makes multi-billion dollar revenues from AIDS medications like Combivir, Trizivir, and of course AZT. The Wellcome Trust is a kind of hybridized British version of NIAID and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. It largely funds studies that tend to promote profit-taking by British pharmaceutical companies. Does Fauci's hypothesis fail Farr's Law? William Farr was the British microbiologist who designed the accepted method for predicting the spread of a new virus across a naive population. Farr declared that every new viral epidemic follows the same intractable laws, spreading exponentially within weeks at most after the first infection, and then declining exponentially as it runs out of new uninfected persons. He declared that the rigid symmetrical rise and fall of death rates was so predictable as to be intractable law. The death rate is a fact. Anything beyond this is inference. New infectious disease epidemics can virtually all be reliably plotted in a predictable bell curve resembling in appearance Farr's graph from London's 1849 cholera epidemic. The predictable spread of infectious disease with Farr's Law. Scientists who accepted Dr. Fauci's hypothesis that HIV was a new virus were initially confident that they could accurately predict a catastrophic spread in a naive human population. But all those predictions were wrong. At the end of each year, HIV's disappointing performance in imposing mortalities forced CDC to revise its estimates precipitously downward. Instead of a steep rise in infections, CDC's annual estimates of how many Americans are infected with HIV between 1986 and 2019 has remained fairly constant at approximately 1 million. HIV did not spread or kill at anywhere near the rate expected of a newly introduced sexually transmitted virus. The growth of HIV in Africa and the West does not follow the laws that have governed population-wide viral pandemic transmission throughout history. Since 1984, HIV has followed a steady monotonic point trajectory, spreading from 29 million in 1998 to 49 million in 2008. In Africa and elsewhere, the graph of AIDS has been a gradual, steady slope, following the population growth almost perfectly country by country without any of the widely predicted decreases in population. The spread of AIDS in the United States post-1985. Dr. Rebecca Culshaw, a mathematical biologist and former AIDS researcher, went from unquestioning believer to converted heretic. The initial irony that captured her attention was the paradox of the preventive cure. It is, she observes, indisputable fact that neither AIDS nor HIV have spread like they were predicted to. The predicted heterosexual AIDS explosion never happened, and even to mention this prediction now is almost taboo, as it is clearly an embarrassment to the AIDS establishment if HIV has not spread at all, but rather it has remained constant in the population since its detection. In Western countries, AIDS has never broken away from its original core pool of homosexual men and drug addicts. That limit defies the pattern of every infectious and sexually transmitted disease throughout history. By definition, there can be no viral disease that does not break out of risk groups, paupers consuming gays and those addicted to and frequently using hard drugs. This is especially true for HIV because, as Dr. Fauci's acolytes claim, this is supposed to be the most infectious virus that has ever existed. Assuming that is true, it is baffling that the virus did not frequently spread to women through sexual contact and did not affect all people all over the world equally. It is especially baffling that AIDS does not spread to prostitutes except those who use intravenous drugs. The fact that AIDS does not obey the accepted rules that have reliably governed every other plague known to mankind is, Duesberg says, just more evidence that HIV is an innocent bystander or a passenger virus. Enforced consensus in a sea of dissenting voices. The press long ago stopped reporting voices of dissent, but you now know those voices are real. It's like dying in outer space, Ortleb told me. No one can hear you scream. But before questioning the orthodoxy became career suicide, some of the world's most prestigious scientists expressed such skepticism. It's worth revisiting some of those voices. We do not yet know how HIV causes AIDS, Dr. John Coffin of Tufts University, a member of the international committee that named the virus, told the delegates to the 6th International Conference on AIDS in June 1990. Dr. Xing Lo, director of AIDS pathology at the United States Armed Forces Institute of Pathology, from 1986 through 2008, insisted that HIV could not be the sole cause of AIDS. In 2002, Dr. Bruce Evatt, CDC's director of the Division of Hematology, lamented that the CDC went to the public with statements for which there was almost no evidence. We did not have proof it was a contagious agent. In September of 2004, Reinhard Kurt, former director of the Robert Koch Institute, one of the pillars of mainstream AIDS research, conceded in Der Spiegel, "We don't exactly know how HIV causes disease." In 1987, physiologist and MacArthur Grant winner Robert Root Bernstein told ABC correspondent John Hockenberry that he does not believe that HIV is necessarily the cause or the sole cause of AIDS. I've had people tell me bluntly that I agree totally with your viewpoint that there are probably other things involved, that HIV can't cause AIDS by itself, that maybe you can get AIDS in the absence of HIV, but I'm not going to risk my $1 million of funding by saying that. Harvard Nobel Prize-winning molecular biologist Walter Gilbert told Hockenberry, "The major thing that concerns me, like calling HIV the cause of AIDS, is that we do not have a proof of causation. That's our major reason for being concerned." Gilbert also said the problem with the HIV theory is the argument that all cases of AIDS are associated with the virus, and there is an inference made that all people with the virus will ultimately come down with AIDS. That's, of course, not known to be a fact. South Africa's pioneering AIDS researcher and physician, Dr. Joseph Sonnabend, chimed in, "The harm in the whole notion of the speculation being presented as fact is that if the speculation proved to be true, that means that research on whatever is truly going on has been neglected, and this, of course, with a disease like AIDS, can be translated into the loss of tens of thousands of lives." Says prominent New York AIDS doctor Michael Lang, assistant head of infectious diseases and epidemiology at St. Luke's Hospital, "We've lost years in AIDS drug development because of the Gallo, Essex, Hazeltine axis boycotting other ideas." This chapter has outlined a meager skeletal description of just a few of the most common critiques of the hypothesis Dr. Fauci defends at all costs. Interested readers may find much more eloquent and thorough investigations in a number of books by various authors. Perhaps the best of these is mathematician Rebecca Colshaw's Science Sold Out. Colshaw was an AIDS researcher who slowly became disillusioned by the gaping chasms in the HIV/AIDS hypothesis and by government corruption in maintaining the orthodoxy. Her book offers a sociological explanation as to how the theory was anointed by the media and scientific community. Other important books are Duisberg's Inventing the AIDS Virus, Lauritsen's book The AIDS War, Osler's Web by Hillary Johnson, and Harvey Bialy's Oncogenes, Aneuploidy, and AIDS. I also recommend The Deconstruction of the AIDS article by Yale mathematician Serge Lang, and an insightful chapter titled Fear and Lawyers in Los Angeles in Kerry Mullis's Dancing Naked in the Mind Field. Instead of civilly debating these dissidents and writers and common sense questions posed by Duisberg and other critics, Dr. Fauci's strategy has been to exercise his frightening capacity to silence dissent and mangle reputations. History may credit him as the progenitor, even the inventor, of cancel culture. My purpose here is not to take sides, much less to resolve disputes that have so far defied resolution for decades. Rather, I'm sharing something few people have been allowed to know, that there is a dispute and that Tony Fauci has not allowed study that might resolve it. My hope is to chronicle Tony Fauci's role as high priest of an orthodoxy that today supports a multi-billion-dollar global enterprise. Over the years, Dr. Fauci has deflected and evaded scientific debate and transformed theories into quasi-religious dogma, punishing and silencing dissent the way the Inquisition punished heresy. America's doctor has never given the American taxpayers or AIDS sufferers, 53% of whom are in the United States people of color, proof that AZT or its successive antivirals provide beneficial impacts on mortality. It seems fair, if not dangerous, to ask for that proof. Please go to the Children's Health Defense website for the acknowledgments and notes by chapter, updates to data, and new information that becomes available on any of the subject matter covered in this audiobook.